There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
In a conference room overlooking Midtown Manhattan, seven men sit at a table. One man repeatedly taps his pencil against his other hand. He gets up and goes to a telephone.
I want Jake Ross's secretary, please.
Williams, we're still waiting for your Mr. Ross.
I'm trying to get him right now, sir. Joni, where is he? I know he's out to lunch, but we had a conference call here for 2 o'clock. It's now 2:30. Now, where is he? All right, check around. Call Sardis East or the Colony and tell him to get himself over here in a hurry.
He clutches his stomach and wipes his brow, then returns to the conference table.
Well, where is your protege with the $3 million automobile account?
He's due at any moment, Mr. Misrael. Probably a big lunch crowd or something.
Don't be an idiot. More likely a big martini, or 3, or 4 of them.
He was too young to put on this account. I told you that, Williams. I kept telling you that. He's much too young to put on this large and important account.
Williams goes to the door, where a woman hands him a piece of paper. He unfolds and examines it. Then lowers the piece of paper.
We have now been here 34 minutes, Mr. Williams.
This is a communication from Jake Ross.
Would you be so kind as to share its contents with us?
I can give you the sense of it very quickly, Mr. Misrael. This is Jake Ross's resignation. He's moving over to another agency.
And?
And he's taking the automobile account with him.
That account represented a gross billing of something in the neighborhood of $3 million a year. And how many times have you promised it to me?
This is as much a shock to me as it is to you, Mr. Misrael.
Don't sit down. And don't con me, Williams. It was your pet project. Your pet project. Then it was your idea to give it to that little college greenie. Now get with it, Williams.
Standing up.
Get with it, boy. So what's left, Williams? Not only has your pet project backfired, but it sprouted wings and left the premises. I'll tell you what's left to us, in my view. A deep and abiding concern about your judgment in men. This is a push business, Williams. A push, push, push business. Push and drive. But personally, you don't delegate responsibilities to little boys. You should know it better than anyone else. A push, push, push business, Williams. It's push, push, push all the way, all the time. It's push, push, push all the way, all the time, right on down the line.
Fat boy, why don't you shut your mouth?
Williams gets up and rushes out of the conference room. He again clutches his stomach and grimaces. The women in the typing pool stare at him.
Mr. Williams, messages are on the desk, and there's some hot coffee here. Can I bring you some?
No, thanks.
Or want anything at all?
Yeah. A sharp razor and a chart of the human anatomy showing where all the arteries are.
He goes in his office and shuts the door. Turns out the light. Sits down at his desk.
Mr.
This is Gart Williams, age 38. A man protected by a suit of armor, all held together by one bolt. Just a moment ago, someone removed the bolt, and Mr. Williams' protection fell away from him and left him a naked target. He's been cannonaded this afternoon by all the enemies of his life. His insecurity has shelled him. His sensitivity has straddled him with humiliation. His deep-rooted disquiet about his own worth has zeroed in on him, landed on target, and blown him apart. Mr. Gart Williams, ad agency exec, who in just a moment will move into the Twilight Zone in a desperate search for survival.
On a train, a conductor walks up to Williams.
How are you tonight, Mr. Williams?
In the absolute pink.
Cold winter this year. Seems to get darker earlier than it ever has.
Well, that's the way of the world. The rich get richer, and the days get shorter.
That's right.
He walks off. Williams closes his eyes.
A push, push, push business. Push and drive. It's push, push, push all the way, all the time. Right on down the line.
That's enough.
The man seated in front of him turns his head. Williams pulls down the window shade and reclines in his seat. He falls asleep. He wakes up. Alone in a stationary, antique rail car. He pushes up the window blind. The station sign reads, Willoughby. Outside, a man pedals a bicycle with an enormous wheel across the square, past a gazebo towards a horse-drawn carriage. Two barefoot boys carry long fishing poles. A man waves from a horse-drawn carriage labeled Depot Bus.
Willoughby, his stop is Willoughby,
says a conductor.
Willoughby, his stop is Willoughby.
What do you mean, Willoughby? Where's Willoughby?
That's Willoughby right outside.
Oh, wait a minute, what's going on? There's no stop on this line called Willoughby. And look at it outside. The sun is out, it's summer.
That's what she is, mid-July. A real warm one, too.
Wait a minute, it's November. What's going on here anyway? It's November. Where is this place? Where is Willoughby?
Willoughby, sir? That's Willoughby right outside. Willoughby. July. Summer. It's 1888. Really a lovely little village. You ought to try it sometime. Peaceful. Restful. Where a man can slow down to a walk and live his life full measure.
Willoughby. The stop is Willoughby. Willoughby. The stop is Willoughby.
Williams runs to the end of the car and stops to look out. And he is jostled as the train starts up again. He wakes up, back on his regular commuter train. He raises the window shade and looks at the falling snow.
Westport Saugatuck, next stop. Westport Saugatuck. Have a good sleep, Mr. Williams?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a good sleep. With an idiotic dream. Idiotic. You ever hear of a town called Willoughby?
Willoughby? Willoughby where?
Willoughby, Connecticut, I guess, or Willoughby, New York.
Not on this run. No Willoughby on the line. Westport Saugatuck, next stop. Westport Saugatuck.
Williams stands up, dons his hat, and gets off the train. At home, he fills his glass from an ice bucket and a decanter as his wife descends a staircase into the living room.
And what are your plans for this evening? To get quietly plastered and then sing old college songs?
It's been one of those days.
I know all about it. Bob Blair's wife called me. She told me he'd been in the meeting with you. You got hysterical or something? Well, she called to find out how you were.
They were all very solicitous, all the boys at the meeting. That free-flowing compassion that is actually relief. I'm the victim, not them. They've mistaken an intake of breath for an outpouring of sympathy.
Would you spare me your little homilies now? Please, and just give me a simple and direct and honest answer. Did you wreck a career this afternoon? Did you throw away a job?
It appears not. Mr. L. phoned before I left the office. He has found it in that great, oversized heart of his to forgive. The somewhat obese, gracious gentleman will allow me to continue in his employ because he's such a human-type fella. With the small, insignificant, parenthetic additional reason that if I were to go to a competitive agency, I might possibly take a lot of business with me.
Go on.
That's it. That's all of it.
She pours herself a drink.
Oh, I'm tired, Janie. I'm tired, and I'm sick.
Well, then you're in the right ward. We specialize in people that are sick. And tired, too, Garth. I'm sick, and I'm tired of a husband who lives in a kind of permanent self-pity. A husband with a heart, bleeding sensitivity that he unfurls like a flag whenever he decides the competition is a little too rough for him.
Some people aren't built for competition, Janie. Or big pretentious houses they can't afford. Or rich communities they don't feel comfortable in. Or country clubs they wear around their neck like a badge of status.
And you would prefer?
I would prefer, though never asked before, a job, any job, any job at all where I could be myself. Where I wouldn't have to climb on a stage and go through a masquerade every morning at 9 o'clock and mouth all the dialogue and play the executive and make believe I'm the bright young man who's on his way up, because I'm not that person, Janie. You've tried to make me that person, but that isn't me. That isn't me at all. I'm a not very young, soon to be old, very uncompetitive, rather dull, quite uninspired, average-type guy. With a wife who has an appetite.
And just where would you be if it weren't for my appetite?
I know where I'd like to be.
Where's that?
He steps away from her, sits on the floor.
Place called Willoughby. A little town I manufactured in a dream.
She sits down in a chair.
Well, tell me about your dream, Guard.
It's an odd dream. Very odd dream. Willoughby. It was summer. Very warm. The kids were barefooted. One of them had a fishing pole. It all looked like a Currier and Ives painting. Bandstand, bicycles, wagons. I've never seen such serenity. It was the way people must have lived 100 years ago. Crazy dream.
Yeah.
She stands up.
You let me know when you wake up, huh, Guard?
No, wait a minute, Janie. Please, Janie!
You know what the trouble with you is, Guard? You were just born too late. Because, you know, you're the kind of a guy that could be satisfied with a summer afternoon or an ice wagon being drawn by a horse. So it's my mistake, pal. My error. My miserable, tragic error. To get married to a man whose big dream in life is to be Huckleberry Finn.
She heads up the stairs.
Yeah. Maybe. Something like that. Place. Time where a man can live his life full measure. That's what he said. That's what that conductor said. A place where a man can live his life full measure.
Back on the commuter train, Williams reads the paper.
Willoughby?
What?
Last week you asked me about a town called Willoughby, Mr. Williams. Well, I looked it up. Every old timetable I could find. No such place, far as I could see.
Thanks. It was a dream, is all.
probably was. Stamford, next stop. Next stop, Stamford. Stamford. Stamford, next stop. Stamford.
Williams lowers the window shade.
Next stop, Stamford.
Lies back in his seat.
Stamford, next stop. Willoughby. Stop is Willoughby.
Opens his eyes.
Willoughby. Stop is Willoughby. Willoughby, sir.
Willoughby?
Yes, sir. Willoughby.
Willoughby. All out for Willoughby. Willoughby. Stop is Willoughby.
Williams looks out at the square. A couple of kids sit on barrels. A woman walks with a parasol. A band plays in the gazebo. Williams grabs his coat and briefcase and heads for the end of the car. As he looks out at the square, the train starts up.
Conductor! Conductor! Conductor!
Again on the commuter train.
Conductor!
You all right, Mr. Williams?
He stares, bewildered, at the conductor.
Yeah. Sure, I'm all right.
Furrowing his brow.
Willoughby. Next time I'm going to get off.
In the window, the snow and his own reflection.
I'm going to get off at Willoughby.
A telephone sits on his desk with a handset lying next to it.
Williams is a show with Zazz, an entertainer with moxie. We've got to take the audience by the ears and give them a yank.
Behind the desk, Williams crumples up pieces of paper.
I understand, Mr. Misro.
Now it's got to be bright, Williams. Bright with patter.
I'm trying to get
comedy. And everything push, push, push.
Of course, sir.
Now it's got to be bright, Williams. Push, push, push.
He opens a desk drawer and takes out a bottle of pills.
I understand, Mr. Misro. I understand.
Tomorrow morning, Williams,
swallows some pills, screws the cap back on, puts it back in the desk drawer, washes them down with a glass of water.
With a few details as to how we integrate the commercials within the body of the show.
I understand, Mr. Misro, I understand. I'll do the best I can.
Do more than you can. Aspire. Dream big and then get behind it.
Holds his hand on his forehead.
Push.
Yes, sir.
He hangs up and his other phone rings.
Yes. Well, I haven't seen the ratings on the show. No? Well, that's the time slot the sponsor wanted. Oh, hang on a minute, will you? Yes? They what? Hold on just a second. Helen!
She walks in.
What film outfit did the commercials on the Bradbury account? The negatives are all scratched. They're screaming bloody murder.
I'll have to check it for you, sir. Mr. Misro would like to see you.
I'll have to check it out for you here.
Mr. Misro, sir.
I'll let you know when I know something.
Mr. Williams. Mr. Misro seemed very insistent. Mr. Williams.
He hangs up both phones and runs to the washroom.
Mr. Williams. Mr. Misro.
Hunches over the sink, then raises his head toward the mirror. Misro's head hovering over his in the mirror.
Push, 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 Williams. Push, 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 Williams. Push, 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 Williams.
The glass shatters. He stumbles back into his office, clutches his stomach.
Will you give me Westport, Connecticut, please? Capital 79899. Yes, please. Janie, there's a guard, honey. I'm coming home. Will you stay there? I just want you to stay there. No, honey, listen, please.
I've had it. Understand? I've had it. I just can't take this another day, not another hour. This is it, right now. I've got to get out of here. Janie, will you help me, please? Will you please help me? Janie?
He slowly hangs up the phone next to Jane's portrait on his desk. On the train.
How are you tonight, Mr. Williams?
He nods his head, looks straight ahead.
Stamford, next stop. Stamford. Next stop, Stamford. Next stop, Stamford.
He lowers the shade.
Stamford, next stop. Stamford.
And dozes off.
Willoughby. Willoughby. Stop is Willoughby.
Willoughby?
Yes, sir.
He raises the window blind and looks at the village square. The conductor motions for him to exit. Williams gets up, turns back and tosses his briefcase, and walks to the end of the car. He steps off the train as the boys with the fishing poles walk by.
Hi, Mr. Williams.
Hi, boys. You catch some big ones today, huh? I think tomorrow I'll join you.
Plenty of room and lots of fish.
As the boys walk off, he looks at the station sign, and he's greeted by the man with the horse-drawn carriage.
Hiya, Mr. Williams. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
He walks toward the bandstand. The conductor smiles on the platform and checks his pocket watch. A grandfather clock reads 9:50. At night, two train men walk with lanterns on the ice and discover a body on the ground.
Just jumped off the train, did he?
Shouted something about Willoughby, then ran out to the platform, and that was the last I saw him. Doctor says he must have died instantly. They're going to take him into town for an autopsy. Funeral parlor there sent the ambulance.
Two men arrive carrying a stretcher. They wrap up the body and lift it.
Poor fella.
The four men lift the stretcher into the ambulance. On the back of the ambulance, the words, Willoughby and Son, Funeral Home.
Willoughby? Maybe it's wishful thinking nestled in a hidden part of a man's mind. Or maybe it's the last stop in the vast design of things. Or perhaps for a man like Mr. Gart Williams, who climbed on a world that went by too fast, it's a place around the bend where he could jump off. Willoughby, whatever it is, it comes with sunlight and serenity, and is a part of the Twilight Zone.
Credits. Directed by Robert Parrish. Written and narrated by Rod Serling. Produced by Buck Houghton. Executive producer for Cayuga Productions, Rod Serling. Starring James Daly and Howard Smith, Patricia Donahue. With Jason Wingreen, Mavis Neild, James Maloney. Music by Nathan Scott. Director of photography, George T. Clemens. Production manager, Ralph W. Nelson. Art directors, George W. Davis, Merrill Pye. Assistant director, Don Klum. Film editor, Joseph Gluck. Set decorations, Henry Grace, Keel Gleason. Sound, Frank Milton, Philip Mitchell. Animated title by UPA. Copyright 1960 by Cayuga Productions, Inc. Filmed at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. Audio description by Lou Lasher.